The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of July 10th, 2017. On this week's show, we'll talk to Daniel Harnsberger, the professional wrestler known as the Progressive Liberal, about how he invented his Hillary Clinton-loving character, what the Democrats need to do to win the 2018 midterms, and how he's planning to survive an upcoming Dukes of Hazzard festival in Virginia. Brian Curtis of The Ringer will be here to help us assess Fox's ouster of Shoutfest show mastermind Jamie Horowitz and where ESPN's biggest rival goes from here. And we'll chat with Slate's NBA columnist Nick Green about Kevin Durant taking less cash so the Golden State Warriors can stay together and whether the league should shove the Eastern Conference into Yucca Mountain. Stefan Fatsis is out this week. Filling in for him, we're very lucky to have a genuine cyber human, our nation's foremost thinker on the role of Fox Sports 1 in our society. It's Slate writer Ben Mathis-Lilly. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Josh.
Cyberhuman, of course, being Jason Whitlock's term of art for something that only Jason Whitlock understands.
It's a thing that's online that he doesn't like.
And you are the quintessential thing online that Jason Whitlock doesn't like. Our first guest this week came to my attention via a Deadspin post published 2 weeks ago with the headline, "The Progressive Liberal is Maybe the Perfect Wrestling Heel." That item introduced the world to a man who cuts promos for his matches in the Appalachian Mountain Wrestling Circuit while wearing a shirt plastered with various images of Hillary Clinton's face. Here's an example of some of his work on the microphone.
You people need to be reprogrammed. You continually vote against your own interests. You put people in Congress, in the White House, that aren't going to help you. They're not going to bring your jobs back. So let me tell you what the progressive liberal Daniel Richards is going to do. We're going to reprogram you. We're going to re-educate you. We're going to teach you to read and write. We're going to help you get jobs with clean energy.
I am hoping that by the end of this segment, I will have a job with clean energy. My fingers are crossed. Although he wrestles as Daniel Richards, our hero's real name is Daniel Harnsberger. And when he's not changing voters' minds, he is a real estate agent in Richmond, Virginia. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Josh. It's good to be on.
So you explained in an interview with Sports Illustrated, it was a really good interview, where you got the idea for your character. Can you explain that to folks who might not have seen that interview?
Yeah, well, it's me. It's not, so I'm not like, I'm not pretending to be like someone else or taking on another persona. It's just me amped up. You know, I'm much more quarrelsome than I am in every day. So it's just, that's what it is in a nutshell. You know, we use the words character and persona for, you know, lack of a better term, but that's, at the end of the day, it's just Dan turned up. And it was born, you know, it was just born out of the, my mentor, Bo James, told me when I start, not, I'd been wrestling maybe a couple of years and had a real rough night, you know, as far as in the ring, it's not a good showing. And, you know, he got on me pretty hard. And one thing he told me is you have to find yourself. So I didn't really know what that meant per se at that time, you know, as it related to wrestling. And then, you know, in 2014, I came up with the idea, like, just, I felt like it would, you know, I knew where I was wrestling, I knew the people, and I felt like it would get some heat, you know, and have some legs. And I could hear interviews in my mind, think of things I would say relevant to that time. And then it wasn't until late 2015, like November 2015, I was at a small show, and the guy run that show, his name was Randy Hicks. He said, "Hey, I just want you to be the best bad guy you can be today." But I kind of had like an open invitation to do whatever I wanted. So I was like, "I'm going to try this." And, you know, at that point, Trump had announced his candidacy a few months earlier, and you know, that was plenty of material right there, and never stopped.
My favorite thing that I think you may have said that first night was about building a wall, but instead of building the wall, around Mexico, building it around the audience in Kentucky.
Yeah, building. Yeah, that was in West Virginia.
And, oh, sorry.
No problem. This is building it around that town so they can infiltrate the population. That's the one thing I said that night that I can vividly remember, and it got, you know, relative to the crowd size, it got a very strong response. I knew I had something. I just ended up working for other promotions, and you know, that's why I came up with the name, the Progressive Liberal. You know, the moniker in front of Daniel Richards, which I've always wrestled with Dan or Daniel Richards, and you know, just it continued to evolve from there. You know, a lot of self-discovery on my part, a lot of learning, and then you know, as it relates to Appalachian country, is helping Bo's really helped me, you know, better understand the people there and why they are how they are and the history and things like that, and that helps.
What I'm most curious about, and people listening really need to look up a picture of your Hillary Clinton shirt, which involves some, it's like 50 or 60 pictures of Hillary pasted over each other in a way that kind of suggests a nightmare or an acid trip. I just want to know where you got that shirt in it and whether you're maybe going to be able to market them to the rest of us.
Well, I wish I could tell you right now that I designed it, because I'd probably be making some extra coin if I had. But I Googled it, and I wish I could tell you the name of the website. But I mean, I didn't think I'd need that information for, you know, the notoriety that would come. Because I got it like a year ago, and I was just, I sent an image of it to a few of the guys, and I was like, all the heat will now be mine, and all of it. And I don't think I was too far off, but I just did a Google search. Again, I'd love to say I did differently. And then I don't know, like, what the if that falls under how that goes under fair use or not, because people have wanted me to put that in my T-shirt shop, which I have on I have a T-shirt store at whatamaneuver.net. You just look up Progressive Liberal Daniel Richards. I don't have any images of Hillary and myself in that, but I've broached the subject, so they're looking. What a maneuver people are having their attorneys or the people research it.
So my question for you is there an embedded critique of the Democratic Party buried like a few layers within your ring commentary? Because this is not how one would go about persuading voters to make an extraordinarily obvious point. There's been so much conversation among those of us in the media about what the role of the press is after the election, whether, you know, we should be going to Appalachia to try to understand the people and why they're quote unquote voting against their interests. And obviously, like, hectoring and lecturing them from a squared circle is not the way to go about, you know, getting votes for 2018 or 2020. So is there, again, some sort of critique that you're making there about the way that Democrats or the press have gone about trying to change voters' minds?
No. I mean, you got to remember, yes. The short answer is no. But the long answer, the long but to the point answer is, okay, my audience is not coming to talk about policy or hear about policy. You know, it's not a town hall meeting. You know, it's the marquee says wrestling, and, you know, politics is only a small part of the character. You know, I know that audience, you could try to do everything you could to make me cheered by those people. It's not going to happen. Okay. So we're going for one reaction or the other. We want them to hate the bad guy and want to see him get their butts kicked by the good guy. And we want them to love the good guy kicking our butts. Right. So I've got one or two choices. So I choose the former. But one thing that's not veiled, like, because some people have thought, like, oh, this is actually a conservative guy pretending to be a liberal guy. Like, it, that's what the people at MSNBC thought at first before they started watching footage. And then they figure out, oh, no, he's an actual liberal. And then people have interviewed me to find that very quickly. But my message is really that, like, I'm the bold Democrat, which, you know, we get labeled as snowflakes and all that stuff. And that's just a bunch of Ann Coulter right wing BS to me. But there is some truth in it. And progressive liberal is the one that boldly will go into the lion's den and, you know, speak and speak their piece and be unapologetic about it. And I think that's how Democrats need to be. They need to have A, a clear message, and B, you know, be bold about it and be unapologetic about it. That's what Republicans do. I mean, I don't know how clear their message is, but at the end of the day, the way they're perceived is the party of God and morality and you know, they're conservatives when there's really not too much that's actually conservative or consistent about them.
Ben, what do you think the Democrats can learn from the progressive liberal?
Well, I was going to say, I think that Bernie Sanders just had a pretty large rally in West Virginia. It was related to the Republican health care bill in the Senate. But obviously, Bernie Sanders is a supporter of Medicare for all or universal coverage, however you would put it. So I would say that that Bernie going into that area of the country and saying what he did say, I think that's a sign that that Daniel's already having an effect. I mean, who's to say that Sanders would have done that if the progressive liberal hadn't paved the way for him?
Well, Bernie's an exception to the rule. I love Bernie. I don't have a Bernie Sanders collage shirt on because those people aren't going to, it's not going to get the same reaction. You know, Hillary is, you know, universally hated. You know, I mean, we had in this election, you know, I voted for Hillary, obviously. But this last election was the least two popular candidates of all time. And then they're running against each other for our nation's highest office. But, you know, just Bernie wouldn't bring the same type of reaction. So, you know.
So your success and the fact that you've gotten so much media attention, CBS News is going to be following you around this week. The obvious question here is, why are you the first pro wrestler to seize on the seemingly obvious fact that people hate liberals who love pro wrestling? So Vince McMahon has a connection and affiliation with Donald Trump. His wife, Linda, is a Republican, potential office holder who never seems to win elected office. But do you think that Vince's ties to the Republican Party have blinded him to the possibilities here? I mean, there have been Soviet wrestlers who've, generated heat. There was like Sergeant Slaughter's sympathies with the Iraqis was a big thing back in the day. This just seems like such a big missed opportunity for the bigger wrestling promotions. I wonder what's going on here.
Well, the difference between WWE and like, an independent promotion like Appalachian Mountain Wrestling is that we're not a publicly traded company, unlike WWE. And also we have local sponsors, but it's not, we don't have this major national TV deal and all that stuff riding on it. So there's no stakeholders, dictating our content. So we can bring people high and we can bring people low. We don't have to be, our focus doesn't have to be putting smiles on people's faces, which is, WWE's philosophy. And I'm not knocking them for that because it's a different ball game, just being publicly traded alone. And I understand that.
You'll knock everyone who lives in a red state, but you won't knock the WWE.
No, I mean, for God's sake, I wouldn't mind being employed there, but I mean...
Do they have any jobs that that are clean energy jobs? That's what we need.
We can only hope so. But yeah, I mean, it is what it is for them, and we have a little more creative freedom. I mean, there's things that we don't touch that, you know, I don't think any wrestling promotion would touch, like religion. And we also don't talk about local politics. We only touch on national politics and broad brushstrokes. You're not going to hear me talk about Betsy DeVos being a terrible abomination of a Secretary of Education. You know, it's, you know, Trump's the head of the snake, and usually, when I'm in Kentucky, I'll talk about Mitch McConnell. That doesn't get, you know, there's no Mitch McConnell chance, and I guess that's a good thing. Ben, but there are tons of Donald Trump chants.
Ben, do you have any Mitch McConnell related promos that you could give the progressive liberal?
I mean, you know, he kind of looks like, you know, Montgomery Burns from the Simpsons. I mean, he has
that's an insult to Mr. Burns.
He has that affect, the kind of gnarled affect of a great villain. But yeah, I'm not sure that his insults to the procedural norms of the U.S. Senate carry over quite as well as some of the things about the wall.
No, talk bad about Reagan, talk bad about Trump, and, you know, you got them. And then, you know, talk about, you know, pronouncing words differently than they do. And it's heat.
So you're going to be wrestling at a Dukes of Hazzard themed festival in Virginia on the last week of July. You've got events coming up this week in London, Kentucky, Ashland, Kentucky, Hazzard, Kentucky, a lot of Hazzard going on. I wanted to ask specifically about the Dukes of Hazzard themed festival. It's a crowd that's known for its affection for the Confederate flag.
Right.
What are you expecting there? And does the antipathy towards you, like, how much is the crowd in on the quote unquote joke? And how much do you get the sense that people in the crowd just genuinely hate you and want you to feel pain?
I mean, it's more of the latter. I mean, look, the jig was up a long time ago when Vince McMahon came on the airways. I mean, started with the steroid trial, but definitely if there was any doubt then, I mean, we came on the airways in, I think, 97, and, you know, talked about it being sports entertainment and so on and so forth. I mean, the jig is up. So if they know our outcomes are predetermined, I mean, you also go to movies knowing the outcome's predetermined. That doesn't mean you can cannot be emotionally hooked. It's not like you're at the movie, like I was at Transformers, and I was like, no way Optimus Prime can do that. I mean, you know, so, but it's up to us, especially, you know, in these live events to not disrupt the suspension of disbelief. So that's a challenge. And then, you know, through our interviews and through the stories we tell in the ring, you know, keep them emotionally involved. So when wrestling's done right, that's what you have.
Daniel Harnsberger is the wrestler known as the Progressive Liberal. His finishing move is the Liberal Agenda. You can see him in some upcoming appearances in Kentucky this week. You can follow what he's doing on Facebook and Twitter. We will post the links to those on our show page. Daniel, thank you, and best of luck getting people in red states to hate you.
Josh and Ben, they make it very easy. But I thank you anyways, and thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
In a piece last week for The Ringer, Brian Curtis wrote that Jamie Horowitz molded Fox Sports One in his own image. What that meant in practice was filling the schedule with argument-based programming of the kind he'd pioneered at ESPN, lining up Colin Cowherd and Skip Bayless and Jason Whitlock and Shannon Sharp to embrace debate on a daily basis. As my colleague, Mr. Mathis Lilly, wrote in his assessment of Horowitz and FS1 back in March, the best comparison for Horowitz's plan of action was what Jeff Zucker has been doing at CNN. That is, trying to win an audience via oppositional takes that inspire people on the internet to express feelings of total validation or extreme rage. Horowitz and FS1 hadn't thus far been rewarded with particularly high ratings, and last week he was suddenly let go by Fox amid what news outlets have reported are claims of sexual harassment, claims that Horowitz's attorney has called slanderous. Joining us now to discuss Jamie Horowitz and what he's leaving behind at Fox Sports One is Brian Curtis, editor-at-large for The Ringer. Hey, Brian.
Hey, boys.
And the interesting thing, Brian, about Horowitz's ouster is, you know, you mentioned molding Fox Sports One in his own image. The week before he got let go, he had himself let go 20 writers and editors who were writing for the Fox Sports website, which to my understanding is every writer and editor who is working for the Fox Sports website. This does not seem like a move that someone would make if they thought that they were going to get let go. He was continuing to change what Fox Sports One was doing. Am I correct in thinking that this came as a total surprise to Horowitz and to everyone who worked there?
Absolutely right. One of the biggest questions in our little sports media universe that I would hear from people outside of Fox and even inside of Fox was, how much time does Jamie have? People ask that all the time, given the ratings of the network. I never got any indication before last week that he was on a short leash at all, ever, not once. And I think that whole thing with the website, which I still don't quite understand, not sure why hot takes are okay on TV but not online, indicated that. He was settled in for the long haul.
The ratings for FS1 were comically low. Richard Deitch has a habit of pointing out that they're below, you know, various cartoons that we've never heard of. The question I guess I have is, the vision that Horowitz seems to have had is, let's, you know, acquire, you know, whether it's Skip Bayless or Colin Cowherd, you know, guys who can fill in a lot of airtime, and then we'll kind of like figure it out down the line. It's like a GM who's making a plan to beat the Warriors in 3 or 4 years. So I guess the question is, you know, was that a reasonable strategy, and were there any indications that it was working or was going to work despite the extremely low ratings?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question. We don't quite know the answer to would it have worked. I'd consider it on two levels. One, I always like to think of Bayless and Cowherd, and this sounds like an insult, but it's not, as innings eaters. I mean, they are the kind of guys you can go and they're like, they are on the air for a remarkable amount of time every single day. We talk about famous, we talk about like the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center. Scott Van Pelt does an hour. Those guys do hours and hours and hours of television. So in terms of just like what you're talking about, filling up the network, that's what they were there for. I think the other thing to think about is, like, we have talked so much about how the only thing people will watch on sports television or maybe any television now is live games. And so part of this kind of wait for FS1 was they needed to get lots of interesting games that people actually wanted to watch. And this fall, they're going to start having Big Ten football, which is relevant to someone on this on this segment right now. Like, we turned on, for years, ESPN. If you turn on ESPN on a college football Saturday, they would have Michigan playing some team I didn't care about at noon, like every single day. Like Michigan, Purdue, Michigan, Central Michigan, whatever. That was always on. But that was something
and often
I actually
losing
had
in humiliated fashion to those.
There you
teams
go.
At noon.
It was actually on all the time. But now, like, FS1 will have a taste of that. So I think part of the grand strategy here was, I mean, obviously Skip and Colin, all those guys attracted so much attention. But part of it is, like, we have to have something on this network until we can get games on this network, and then make it something that people will actually want to watch.
That's actually brings up a point I'm interested in. Obviously everyone's going to be looking at, everyone in the subset of people who watch FS1 to begin with, which is, as we know, is a smaller subset than the subset of sports fans. But everyone's going to be looking at whether They continue with this strategy of building around Skip and Shannon and Cowherd and Whitlock. One thing I'm curious about is whether they're going to attempt to cross-promote those people with their big college football games this fall. I mean, it seemed to me to be kind of obvious that if they were ever really going to take off, they had to actually get Skip and get Cowherd kind of deeply involved in broadcast, you know, in the broadcasts of the baseball playoffs, which were, I think, up until this point, probably their biggest rating successes. So I am curious to see whoever comes in, not only are they going to commit to having those guys filling, like you said, 12 hours a day or whatever it is on FS1, but are they going to be bringing the hot takes even closer into the overall Fox Sports orbit?
I would think so. I mean, I think it just makes a whole lot of sense, and we've seen that happen on ESPN where, you know, shockingly, their debate show anchors happen to be talking about exactly what ESPN is showing that night. Colin Cowherd is a really natural match for college football because he's talked about college football forever. In fact, that's one of his signatures as a radio guy going back to his ESPN days. He's one of the few sort of national hosts who really liked and cared about college football. My guess on what they're going to do, and this is purely a guess, is that they double down with these guys. They're so far into Skip Bayless and Colin Cowherd in terms of money, in terms of promotion, and it really makes sense to continue down that road short of a different strategy. And I just think, like, and also, you know, people say, well, what if Fox tries something different? Well, what are they going to try? I mean, Horowitz's whole thing was that the highlight could no longer carry a sports television show by itself, right? I think that's been proven. He was right. Part of the reason he was such a controversial, magnetic, whatever you want to call him, figure in sports TV is that he was right. And there was a lot of truth to that. And so if they pivot, to use a terrible media term we've been hearing a lot lately, what do they pivot to? What do they do? They're going to show highlight shows? They're going to show some kind of fake sports center on FS1? And that's why it makes the most sense to me that they're just going to be doing what they're already doing.
Right. It reminds me of, you know, if highlight shows don't work and they decide that opinion shows don't work, it reminds me of the, I think, the Orlando Magic general manager. This was in the post-Shaquille era when his team was struggling. And he said we play the games at home and we lose, and we play the games on the road and we lose. And so I just am trying to figure out another place to play the games. And if you're not doing highlights and you're not doing opinion and you don't have the rights to, the Big Ten is a step in the right direction for them. But you know, they're obviously not competitive with ESPN, which has a big game on basically every night. You know, it's not clear to me whether there is any other approach at all.
Yeah, and it feels, you know, if it feels jarring and it feels like they have to change course, I think it's because, as Josh said earlier, this network was so molded in Jamie Horowitz's image. Like, everything, down to the website, to the host, to the lineup, to everything was molded in his image. And this idea, I mean, isn't it remarkable, by the way, that we know who this guy is? How many sports TV executives ever, much less currently, could anybody name? Could your basic sports fan name? Two or three? And yet so many people knew who Jamie Horowitz was because he was happy to, you know, talk crap about ESPN, because he was able, but he was sort of this sort of wrestling heel style figure at the head of FS1, but also just because the whole network was his. He did everything on that network, and everything was shaped in his image.
So back to the beginning of Horowitz's career, he started out at ESPN, best known for launching First Take, also did the Keith Olbermann show, had a stint at the Today Show that ended very poorly. Is the fact that he is somebody whose name we know and who we're talking about, is that because he's just a really good self-promoter? Was there something back during his stint at ESPN that made all of these other places want to give him a chance? And I wonder if, I guess it depends on how the investigation into his behavior shakes out, but whether he'll get a chance again.
I don't think anybody would deny that he was good at getting media attention, especially probably his old pals at ESPN who would read those stories and wince. But I think it's probably, the answer is that he did a lot more than just unleash the monster that is sports debate television. I mean, if you look at the ESPN lineup now, his fingerprints are all over it. So we got First Take, right? He promoted and encouraged Michael and Jamel when they were on His and Hers on ESPN2, now the big stars of the 6 p.m. Sports Center. People like Michelle Beadle and Sports Nation, he had a huge hand in. His whole, I think, their whole lineup, and also, you know, they just released a new TV lineup a couple of weeks ago. Shows like Pablo and Bomani. Now, that might not be what we consider a Jamie Horowitz show in the sense that that wouldn't run in the exact same form on FS1, but the idea that you're moving completely toward shows driven by two personalities having an argument or a discussion or whatever you want to call it, that's the Horowitz vision. So I think...
Well, even Scott Van Pelt Sports Center, right, as a personality-based show.
Exactly. And this idea that, you know, like I said, he wouldn't be such a dynamic figure if he wasn't right about highlights and he wasn't right about personality and the way sports TV was going. And ESPN would totally say, oh, no, we're not going down the same path as FS1. And they're not totally, but they certainly have taken steps in that direction. And I think that's probably why he's so influential and well-known.
So there have been some reports in the sports media press that Katie Nolan is maybe on her way out at Fox Sports. When I interviewed Horowitz a few months ago, he went out of his way to praise Katie Nolan and say that she was an integral part of his vision for the network going forward, which was, you know, not only was probably lip service to someone who had, you know, her own fans at the network, but also, you know, as one thing I learned in watching a lot of his shows, he really is not committed to a particular political viewpoint, which I think a lot of people might not realize, just given that his shows tend to be controversial because of the kind of the right-wing orientation of some of the takes that come out of them. But it seemed like he did have an honest commitment, a sincere commitment to keeping Katie Nolan, who's more of a liberal person, in the fold. She's reportedly on her way out, and it seems like that's not necessarily connected to Horowitz's firing. I saw, Brian, you tweet about that, and I was wondering if you had any inside scoop for us on what's going on there.
Well, I think, too, a couple of notes on this. One is that she produced her bargain basement late-night TV show out of New York, and she was never in L.A. doing a daily show for Horowitz with him bringing all of his producing chops to her and him kind of showing her, here's how you can do daily television. I wrote that he was a shadow producer of every show on FS1. That never happened. I think that was something that might have happened had he stayed on, or, you know, depending on what Nolan wanted to do. But that scenario never happened, and that would have been kind of fascinating because you would have taken, as you say, a very different viewpoint than some other people on FS1, but put the Horowitz push and production values and all that stuff behind it. That never happened. The other thing I always found interesting about Katie Nolan and FS1 is her audience on Twitter is sort of the opposite of the audience of FS1, right? On the one hand, we're trying to find viewers that, you know, are happy to watch people yelling at each other on TV or, you know, enjoy that sort of controversy or don't mind a, you know, politically tinged meltdown every once in a while. Katie Nolan's audience on Twitter is like exactly the opposite of that. So whether she would have wanted to go to FS1 and sort of, you know, cross that Rubicon, I don't know. And that's always funny to me. Certainly her going to ESPN in some as yet named capacity tracks with everything that I've heard.
I mean, that's the test that they're going to face with the Bomani Jones and Pablo Torre show as well, right? I mean, both of those guys on their Twitter presence, a lot of it involves kind of sticking up for certain progressive viewpoints in a way that is fairly uncommon in the sports chat or sports talk, sports debate world. But ESPN is going kind of full in on launching a Horowitz-esque show around them. Obviously, he's not going to be producing it himself, but it seems to be that they're going to be doing kind of the liberal version of what Colin and Whitlock are doing.
But I think it's a much safer space on ESPN than it is on FS1 to do that kind of thing. And I think with Katie Nolan, whatever she decides to do, and by the way, I don't really think of her as necessarily a political animal, in the way that some of these other people were talking about. But I think that act sort of fits better with ESPN than maybe it would have with the other place.
We should also note before we go that we are now living in a period of time in which Fox fires or lets go or whatever, you know, euphemism you want to use someone allegedly because of sexual harassment without like 800 claims having piled up first. It's just like an interesting moment in history that this would have happened. Again, just back to what we talked about at the beginning of the segment, just like totally out of the blue without seemingly there being any kind of outside pressure to get Jamie Horowitz out of there.
Yeah, and I think that's why I've hopefully been trying to at all times kind of resist the comparisons to what happened at Fox News, which I think is very, as yet, very different and involves a very different kind of amount of public information. And I'm very much in right. that. Let's see what happens here before we jump off that ledge.
Brian Curtis is editor-at-large for The Ringer. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So there is a rough consensus out there in the world that the winners of the NBA player carousel thus far have been the Wolves. They got Jimmy Butler, the Thunder, who got Paul George, and the Celtics, who got Gordon Hayward, while the losers are the Pacers and the Bulls, maybe to a lesser extent the Jazz, and also the Spurs and the Cavs, the latter two of which have signed Rudy Gay with a torn Achilles and Jose Calderon, who might as well have multiple torn Achilles at this point. The point I'm making here is that this winners and losers game feels rather pointless when everyone is playing a different game from the Golden State Warriors, who managed to keep their team together by re-signing Andre Iguodala and Sean Livingston and Zaza Pachulia and bringing in cheap reinforcements Omri Caspi and Nick Young. All of these moves were abetted by the fact that Kevin Durant took less money than he might have otherwise. He's going to be paid $25 million in salary this year, rather than the max of $34.5 million. Joining us now from Oakland in the shadow of Oracle Arena, so long as it cast an extremely long shadow, it's Nick Green, who just started writing an NBA column for Slate. He has at least written one NBA column for Slate, so this is my way of putting public pressure on him to write more. Hey, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. Given that you are a 15-minute car ride away from Oracle Arena, I assume you've driven there this morning and can give us some inside scoop into the Warriors' state of mind. I'm curious what you think about Durant taking less money and the fact that there is this kind of cycle going on with the Warriors, the fact that, you know, players want to go there and take less money. Durant seems willing not to, you know, accept his fair market value to keep the team together. It does seem like this is in some ways an unfair game they're playing. And I wonder, you know, how you feel about it and how you feel about Durant's decision in particular.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's extremely unfair that he can't even be flawed in the regard of being selfish. He has to also be unselfish. We saw in the finals that his defense has gotten better. He probably played the best he's ever played, but now he's also proving that he's willing to take a essentially $10 million pay cut for the greater good. So yeah, it's very unfair for the rest of the league, but part of it seems like the fact that he's doing this, they would have been good if they didn't get these extra reinforcements, right? I mean, he wasn't going anywhere. They were going to figure this out one way or another.
When they signed him last year, I feel like a lot of the conversation was around this is going to come back to get them at some point. Like, this is a historic rise in the salary cap, and that's the only reason that they can get these four all-stars on the same team, but they're going to have to pay the consequences of you're not going to be able to keep Iguodala, you're not going to be able to keep Livingston. It's going to be extremely top-heavy team. But, you know, Ben, that's not what's ended up happening here. And I sort of feel like we're past the point where we should praise guys for being unselfish, for taking less money. Like, it's slightly fucked that the way to keep a team together is, you know, for an owner to go to the best player, one of the best players in the league, and say, you know, we can't really pay you what you deserve, but really that's the only mechanism that we have as a team to stay together. And you don't want to be selfish, right?
Well, on top of that, the Warriors are built, as has been observed, you know, that dynasty, the first few years of it was built on Stephen Curry having a contract that was absurdly cheap because of his injury history, right? So he was getting paid way less than his performance would have dictated on the open market at that point. To put it into to think about it as, you know, if this were happening in your own workplace, that would be that's kind of a ridiculous situation to be in, where the company's top performer is not only getting underpaid, but everyone else in the world knows it and celebrates it and points to it as the reason for your success.
Well, full disclosure, I'm taking $10 million less so we can both be on this podcast right now. I think that we should get that out there.
I think Josh is right that Durant is not getting praised for being unselfish in the way he might have been, you know, 10 or 20 years ago when we were a little less woke, as it were, about who's ultimately benefiting from this, which is the owner of the Warriors and the other NBA owners. You know, they benefit from having a salary cap, so they don't have to pay top market price for guys like Durant and LeBron James. You know, at the same time, I think that this Durant's move, ultimately that's kind of where that's exactly where I get off board with the kind of burgeoning Bomani Jones led, pro player, pro labor perspective. You know, I think if Kevin Durant.
wait, but Bomani Jones is the only person who is pro player. He's leading the charge.
He has been very vocal about Nowitzki, I think, and Durant.
Yeah, Nowitzki is taking $10 million over 2 years, which is like crazy in a world in which I'm looking at this Ringer article that mentions people that are making a lot more money than Dirk Nowitzki, among them Joe Ingles, who's making like 52 over 4 years. Anyway, continue.
JJ Redick is making 4.5 times as much money as Dirk Nowitzki next year. You know, and I understand where the idea is coming from is, you know, don't accept less than you're worth in order to ultimately, line the pockets of the other 30, or the other NBA owners. But at the same time, I kind of look at it as like, this is also probably a long-term economically smart decision for Kevin Durant, right? I mean, he gets to, now, again, next year, probably be the biggest star, the best performer, the MVP in the NBA Finals, in one of which will probably also, again, be one of the most watched NBA Finals in history. He gets to, as they say, cement his legacy to be a Hall of Fame, guaranteed Hall of Fame player, someone who's probably going to rise rapidly up the charts in the kind of hypothetical who's the best player of all time lists. He's certainly going to get those benefits, and in the long term for Kevin Durant Inc., you know, I think that this is probably a pretty decent investment of a $10 million down here, in order to kind of get to be in the conversation as an all-time NBA great for the rest of his life, more so than if he had decided to get his max value next year from the Hornets, you know. I think that he's probably making the right long-term play.
So, Nick, the big signing last week was Gordon Hayward going to the Celtics. Our media cycle moved so quickly now that the fact that he announced like 3 hours later than people thought he was, like the entire world of NBA Twitter went into a tailspin of, how dare Gordon Hayward make us wait, till 5 instead of 2? I thought we were going to know at 2. What is wrong with this guy? How did you feel about him going to the Celtics and the way the announcement was made?
Well, there was a kind of collective freak out of everyone going, oh my God, is this not happening? Where's he going? And I was a little detached. So rather than be on Twitter all day, which I usually am, found a quick couple of moments to just Google Gordon Hayward Players Tribune, because I knew he would be breaking the news on the Players Tribune. And the first Google result you get for that is his old article, The Case for Gaming. And so I honestly thought that he kind of took this opportunity to make a case for gaming, saying, well, I have everyone's attention here. I'll talk to you about World of Warcraft. But no, it was, he wound up doing exactly what everyone thought he would be doing. And the 3-hour delay, I think if this would have happened 10 years ago, no one would have cared, obviously. But the fact that this is like complete frenzy did make it, you know, it felt like we were all at soccer practice and our parents forgot to pick us up. And it was like, what's happening? What's going on? What's going on right now?
People were crying. Kids were asking for quarters to use the payphone. the thing about the delay that stuck out to me is, you know, the last time that I think anyone would point to that this happened was when DeAndre Jordan, of course, had his epic night of, you know, kind of like night of psychological torment and perhaps, you know, forced imprisonment when Chris Paul and Blake Griffin kind of like kidnapped him and changed and told him, you know, that he needed to come back to the Clippers, and he changed his mind and instead of signing with the Mavericks as he was going to, came back to the Clippers. I also remember Billy Donovan, I believe, took a job with the Orlando Magic a few years ago, only to kind of perform a similar reversal and go back to Florida, you know, kind of. So in these situations, it's kind of always like when this happens, you expect, at least I expected, oh, he's going to go home. He's going to make the sentimental choice to go back to Utah. And what makes this decision just even more of a knife twist for Utah fans is that he thought about it, and he thought about it, and he thought about how much he loved Utah and the memories he'd made there, and then he decided he was leaving. He had decided he had made the right choice to get out of Utah.
And he really buried the lead in that Players Tribune article. He actually did publish it. He made his choice in like the 8th paragraph, and the headline was "Thank You, Utah." So it was very misleading and confusing, I think.
He spent a lot more time just revising the "Why I Love Gaming" story. That was really his main task on July 4th. So that's the only real move of any significance that brought talent from out west to the Eastern Conference. Everything else, Paul George going to OKC, Jimmy Butler going to Minnesota. There's been this major east to west shift that was extremely not needed by the NBA. I've heard people talk about how if it was just the top 16 teams, it would be something like 12, you know, would be from the West. And, you know, the conversation about who is winning and losing the offseason is so context dependent. You have people talking about how the Sixers are a potential playoff team in the East. You know, Ben mentioned them signing J.J. Redick. The core players on their team have either never played an NBA game or have had like two healthy months ever in the NBA. And then you have folks, you know, crapping all over the Pelicans for re-signing Drew Holiday, which admittedly is not a great contract, but they have Holiday, DeMarcus Cousins, and Anthony Davis. And there's really... I'm kind of pessimistic about the Pelicans, but I really don't think there's a chance that they're going to make the playoffs this year. I don't think it's a great chance. And if they're in the East, people would just be throwing parades for them. And this strikes me as a big problem for the NBA, and one that doesn't seem like anyone is talking seriously about addressing. It's one that just people are like throwing their hands up in the air, just saying, you know, what can be done. Do you guys think that something can or should be done about the fact that all the teams in the East are terrible?
I mean, you know, what we really need is some heavy-handed behind-the-scenes kind of David Stern-esque reorganizations of those franchises, right? I mean, the Eastern Conference franchises are losing people because they're run by idiots. I mean, Dan Gilbert is an idiot. James Dolan is an idiot. The people who are running the Bulls are right now are idiots. And... you know, those are like three of the teams that probably should be like the NBA's like premier properties, you know, like, and there's the teams that are going to, unfortunately, you know, in the case of the Bulls, end up on TV a lot, on national TV a lot, no matter what. So, yeah, I mean, I think that like what I would prefer to see is just some moving and shaking by Adam Silver and get the clowns out and get some actual sensible people in those franchises.
Yeah, and it's pretty complicated too, because on the one hand, the NBA has become this 365-day-a-year event their off-season stuff is, you know, when's the last time you thought about the NFL? It seems like years ago I had to think about that. So that's really good for the NBA, and I'm sure Adam Silver loves that, and that's facilitated 100% by player movement and kind of enabling this kind of open market of during the summer of players going everywhere. And that has also resulted in all the good players going to the West, which was already much better. And that's
just player movement. It's significant player movement. I think the difference with the NFL is that none of the transactions or most of them just don't really matter.
Yeah. And certainly, and there's in the NFL, it's an offensive lineman moving teams might be the most important move of the offseason, but people don't really, you know, watch football for the offensive linemen. Whereas the NBA, there's just fewer players. They're kind of, I think the connection the fans have with them, could be arguable, but I think is stronger or more personal because it's a kind of more personality driven sport. But just the fact that the reason it's a big deal is because these players can move around, and eventually you're going to have some lopsided results because of that. And that's what I think what we're seeing this off season.
Also just because, you know, like the weather on the East Coast is bad and it's not fun to live on the East Coast anywhere north of Miami, which not coincidentally is one team that has really had a lot of success in this era.
And in the Miami's going to be underwater in 3 years, so you can't take a long-term contract there.
Right.
And the thing is, it's like everyone's going to lose to the Warriors. So if I were a player, I would just go somewhere warm and lose where the weather's nice.
There is something to be said for that. Well, then, Ben, you shouldn't be talking about, you know, Chicago and New York as the places that are the most disappointing. What about your Orlando's? What about your Atlanta's? These should be our, bellwether franchises of the East.
That's a very good point. Some ridiculous percentage of pro athletes from all sports like live within 30 miles of Disney World, like in Orlando. It's like the concentration is ridiculous. So yeah, I mean, just for the convenience of not having to take out a second mortgage, Orlando should be drawing big names.
The continuing badness of the Magic is a really fascinating subplot, because every offseason with free agency, there's always the quote unquote smart guy who's like, there's no state income tax in Florida. Yeah. all the players are going to Florida. And yet somehow, I guess maybe one solution is that if you don't make the playoffs for 10 straight years, you should automatically have your franchise sent to Seattle. That could be a rule change that I would get behind.
I think there would actually be more than one franchise in Seattle now if that were the case. Certainly the Knicks would have been there for a long time.
The more the better. I want to finish up by discussing the T-shirt that the Los Angeles Clippers personnel wore when they were trying and ultimately succeeded in enticing Blake Griffin to stay after Chris Paul had engineered a trade to Houston. So this is a T-shirt. I'm sure you guys have seen it. It has the word Pioneers written on it in a sort of graffiti font. And then above it, I'm looking from bottom to top, you've got Abe Lincoln, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Einstein, JFK, Martin Luther King, Obama, Muhammad Ali, and then at the very top, at the pinnacle of this pyramid of success, is Blake Griffin wearing a Clippers jersey. Did you guys feel like there were any players missing? Like, should Eric Pietkowski have been on this T-shirt? Should what was the name of the person who recorded Donald Sterling? Like, V. Stiviano? Should she have been on there with her visor? Like, what was this missing from an art direction standpoint?
I mean, it's interesting that Obama's on there just from a historical perspective. I'm not sure if Obama has earned the right to be on a shirt with Blake Griffin yet, you know? His legacy is not secure.
If you remember, Einstein did lead the Clippers to the Western Conference Finals, so it is a little appropriate to have him on there.
Who do you think would be – so we've got nine guys on there. Like, who do you think would be the starting five and who would be coming off the bench? I made the joke on Twitter that I will recycle now that Austin Rivers is clearly going to be starting in this team. no matter who's on it. But do you feel like, do you want to bring Obama? You're saying you want to bring Obama off the bench at this point, even though he's one of the few people on this T-shirt who's shown a demonstrable interest in basketball.
You got to have Lincoln. I mean, he's got the height.
Right. I think we all know that Lincoln is probably our best basketball prospect as a president. Absolutely.
He's sad all the time. Do you really want that in your locker room? Just a real sad guy constantly telling stories. I'm going by the Daniel Lewis Lincoln.
Right. Well, yeah, it's kind of the Boogie Cousins of the White House, you know, like a lot of talent, but not necessarily great for the mood of the other people around him.
So Clippers, big free agency winners from an apparel standpoint. Nick Green writes about the NBA for Slate. Thank you very much for joining us, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And every time Ben Mathis Lilly is on the show, we can be sure of speaking of Jim Harbaugh, the man who graces his Twitter profile photo, the man he dreams about nightly, even during the long summer before college football season. I think you mentioned this the last time you were on the show, Ben, but I wanted to take this occasion again to remind people of the strange and frankly alluring fact that Jim Harbaugh is a huge booster of the Legal Services Corporation.
That's right. He was apparently brought in to act in some sort of kind of oversight, you know, oversight board of directors, guy who's vaguely involved role. I think Hank Aaron is also involved in it. But of course, in a particularly Harbaughian fashion, has just gotten really excited about the idea of affordable legal defense for Americans, and has since the program was I think marked for a cut in the budget that the Trump administration put out, has really kind of taken to defending it in a lot of his public appearances.
So if you're in favor of providing financial support for civil legal aid for low-income Americans and you do not support the Michigan football team, I would say check your values. Ben Mathis Lilly, what is your Legal Services Corporation? This is it's an odd introduction, but we're going to do it nonetheless.
Okay. Mine goes back 12 years ago to a column, Slate column I actually still think about a lot. And that's on August 29th, 2005, the writer Neil Pollack described and criticized what he called the cult of the general manager in a Slate piece. Pollack complained that fans and writers were taking the fun out of sports by overhyping and obsessing about team executives, such as baseball general managers Billy Beane and Theo Epstein. Pollack thought there was something off about centering fandom around individuals who, while they may be talented in their own way, are ultimately just guys in suits, who will never themselves make an athletic play that amazes or excites us or inspires us, which is what watching sports is supposed to be about. 12 years after Pollack's piece, the cult of the GM is still alive, and it's most active in the NBA, where promising Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid frequently punctuates his social media posts with the phrase, "trust the process." That's a reference to the philosophy of former Sixers president of basketball operations Sam Hinkie, a famously wonky figure who worked for Bain Capital before getting into basketball and who was pushed out of his job with the Sixers in April of 2016. So what we have here is not just a fan, but an actual player, someone who is actually capable of dunking and making three-pointers and blocking shots and doing all the things that fans actually like to watch, participating in the celebration of a private equity guy who hasn't even worked for his team for a year. So if the way we treated general managers in 2005 was cult-like, the way we treat them now is at the committing mass suicide while wearing white unisex turtlenecks because we think it's the best way to teleport our bodies onto a passing comet stage. And yet today, my legal services after ball goes to that very cult. That's because I've realized in the years since Pollock wrote his article that my most exciting, memorable, and perhaps even meaningful sports spectation experiences have in fact involved organizations who have fully embraced the idea that the most important thing a team can do is to make sure that the right middle-aged individual in a suit is making the right kind of intellectually methodical decisions at the top. In September 2015, for example, I watched from the 12th row of Michigan Stadium as running back Devian Smith brought 109,000 fans to their feet with an astounding, rumbling 60-yard touchdown whose final 35 yards involved what was basically hand-to-hand combat with an unfortunate BYU safety who Smith fought off twice and ultimately threw to the ground before leaping into the end zone. That was the moment for me when my favorite team announced its return to national relevance. And it happened ultimately because interim Michigan athletic director Jim Hackett, an old guy in a suit who happens to be the former CEO of a furniture company, hired Jim Harbaugh, a middle-aged man who wears khakis while he obsesses about the crucial off-the-field details of program management that make a football, college football team what it actually is. In February 2016, meanwhile, I watched a grown man leap into another grown man's arms. Admittedly, the first grown man was me, and the second was my friend Ira, at a Brooklyn sports bar when Stephen Curry sized up and hit a 30-foot buzzer beater to defeat the Oklahoma City Thunder. It was one of the most memorable basketball shots ever, and it was a perfect symbolic encapsulation of a Warriors team that has changed basketball for the better because their admittedly arrogant hedge fund billionaire owner, Joe Lacobe, has turned his eye-roll-worthy obsession with innovation culture into a team that plays audaciously creative and fun-to-watch basketball. Now, the cult of the GM, of course, can have excesses. I'm certain the multiple years during which Sam Hinkie's intentionally and aggressively hopeless last-place 76ers teams got blown off their home court every night were not good for basketball fans. But I'm here to say that there's not anything strange or shameful about being worried about who your team's executives are. That's because fans know that worrying about these middle-aged guys in suits is not an end to itself. It's simply an acknowledgement of the critical role that those guys play in ultimately facilitating the stuff we actually care about. It's an emotional down payment, in other words, that we hope will be rewarded with spectacular plays, dramatic comebacks, and glorious championships. If caring about these things means I'm in a cult, then give me my white unisex turtleneck. All right. Josh, what's your legal services corporation?
Thank you, Ben. So my favorite story from the first week of Wimbledon had nothing to do with Roger Federer or Novak Djokovic or Andy Murray or even Bethany Mattox-Sands' horrific knee injury. It involved coughing, more accurately, allegations of coughing. After her third round victory over Camila Giorgi, French Open champ Yelena Ostapenko said in her post-match press conference, "I was just trying to focus on my game and to be on the court. It was just before my serve, somebody started to cough. I think it's a little bit unsportsmanlike. You're in such a high level in the tournament like Wimbledon, a Grand Slam. I think people have to understand where they are. I was shocked because I think it was from her dad, actually, or her box. I mean, the people who are in her team, they're probably very close to tennis. They probably have to understand how to behave during the points or before the serve." Now, Ben, we're not listening to the clip, but I'd like to imagine that the way she said that was something like this. I mean, the people who are on her team, they're probably very close to tennis. Anyway, our pal Ben Rothenberg, who writes about tennis for the New York Times, added some more texture to the story, tweeting, "Now hearing that someone in the Giorgi box was also coughing in round two before Madison Keys' serves." Now, if you don't know about Camila Giorgi and her dad, who was the one who is accused of doing the coughing, you're missing out on a truly fantastic tale. Giorgi is a 25-year-old Italian. She's gotten as high as 30th in the rankings and is known for hitting the ball very hard. Her father and her coach, Sergio, who was born in Argentina, has a huge mop of gray hair. Ben, when I sent you his photo, you said he looked like either unfrozen caveman tennis dad or a lesser-known member of AC/DC. Or Einstein, if Einstein was stupid. That was my favorite one. But is Sergio Giorgi stupid? Let us examine the evidence. In 2014, another of our tennis pals, John Wertheim, wrote a great long piece for Sports Illustrated that uncovered a world in sports, especially the country club sports like tennis and golf, that we really don't hear about a lot. And that is the world of private investment, that you get businessmen who like want to be around talented young athletes and they'll pony up some money. And in this case, Sergio had solicited financial investments in his daughter's career from a large number of private sponsors. And in exchange, he said he would pay them back in a certain period of time. And instead of paying them back, he, in fact, did not pay them back, which is a great way to finance your daughter's tennis career if you can get away with it. So a representative case is that of Todd Andrews. He is a tennis teacher. He helped the Georgies round up a bunch of these investors as part of an agreement that they'd all be paid back within a year. According to Wertheim from his story in 2014, when Georgie made the fourth round at Wimbledon, an earlier Wimbledon, she earned more than $100,000. Andrews was like, aha, $100,000 is money. I need money from the people that just won the $100,000. So he told Sergio, remember, you owe us. The father's response, yeah, I know. We'll have it soon. Fast forward. Andrews drove the Georgies to Heathrow Airport and dropped them off. I'm reading from Wertheim's story now. No sooner had they said their goodbyes, Andrews says Camilla came running back. Did she come running back with a large check in her hand? No. She came running back saying they had to pay extra baggage fees to check in their luggage and they needed another 400 pounds, which Todd Andrews gave him. At this point, you begin to question whose fault this is. After paying the baggage fee, he says he went months without hearing from the Georgies, though Camilla had won more than $500,000 since her agreement with the sponsors. They say they still have not received a dime from her. Wertheim's last update came a couple of years ago when he said Andrews had filed a civil suit against the Georgies in Florida. I was not able to find an indication of how the case has been adjudicated after searching public record sites. Also, you know, she has been asked about this. She was asked about it in 2014, right after the SI story came out in a press conference. And her response was basically like, I just want to talk about tennis. The reporter responded by saying, you're a 22-year-old woman, you should have to answer to this. And then she was like, I don't really speak English very well. So we don't have a great on-the-record response from Camilla Georgie or her father, who now seems like he might have a coughing problem. That is our show for today. Thanks to Ben Mathis-Lilly for filling in. Our producer is Patrick Ford and our intern is Max Cohen. To listen to past shows and to subscribe or just to reach out, go to slate.com/hangup and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. You should also check out the Political Gab Fest, the original political podcast and still the best. Stars Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, and David Plotz. Come for the great conversations about whatever the hell it is that Donald Trump is doing. Stay for Plotz chattering about eclipses. For the latest episodes, which post on Thursday evenings, go to slate.com/gabfest. I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty. And thanks for listening.